As Isabella came forward, Santan was watching the Prime Minister's craggy bulldog features attentively. She knew that Forster was no philanderer. He could never have reached his position in the iron Calvinistic coils of his party if he had been. But despite the fact that for 30 years he'd been happily and securely married, he was still very much a man, and no man could remain unmoved when he looked at Isabella Courtney for the first time. Santan saw the shift in his gaze, and the way he hid his quick flare of attention behind that formidable frown. Santan and Isabella had planned for this meeting with care. Ever since Isabella had amazed both Santan and Shaza by her sudden declared intention to enter the political arena. "She'll get over it," Shaza predicted. But Santan had shaken her head. "Bella has changed. Something has happened to her since she went to London with you. She went as a flighty, spoiled little bitch. Oh, come on, mater." Predictably, Shaza had risen to his precious daughter's defence, but Santan went on without check. "But she has returned a mature woman. However, there is more than that to it. She has steel now. She has cutting edge. And there is something else." Santan had hesitated as she tried to define it. "She has shed her romantic view of life. It is as though she has experienced a revelation, as though she has suffered and learnt to hate, as though she has come through some portentous crisis and armed herself for whatever lies ahead."
"Oh, it's not like you to make these fanciful flights of imagination," Shaza had chaffed her.
But Santan had insisted. "You mark my words, Bella has found her direction, and she will prove herself as tough and ruthless as any of us."
"Surely not as tough and ruthless as you, mater."
"Have your little joke, Shaza Courtney, but time will prove me right."
Santan's eyes had gone out of focus and squinted slightly. Shaza knew that expression so well when his mother indulged in furious concentration. He called them her scheming eyes. Then her eyes came back into focus.
"She is going far, Shaza, probably further than even you and I could dream. And I am going to help her."
And so Santan had arranged this meeting. And now she watched her granddaughter acquit herself with all the aplomb that she had expected of her. Forster asked Isabella,
"So, how did you enjoy the English winters?" And it was clear that he expected a trivial response. But Isabella said,
"It was worth putting up with them, if only to meet Harold Wilson, and to have a first-hand account of the Labour government's attitude and intentions towards all of us who live in southern Africa." Forster's expression changed as he realized that there was a brain behind that lovely face. He dropped his voice, and they talked quietly for a few minutes longer before Santan intervened again.
"Isabella has just received her doctorate in political theory from London University."
Artlessly, she tossed out a little more ground bait.
"Oh, so," Forster nodded. "Do we have a budding Helen Suzman in our midst?"
He was referring to the only woman member of the South African Parliament, the staunchest champion of human rights, and the only really galling liberal thorn in the complacently thick hide of the nationalist majority. Isabella laughed, that husky sexual chuckle, which she knew could stir even the most hidebound misogynist.
"Perhaps," she agreed, "a seat in the House might be my ultimate ambition, but that is still a far way ahead, and I don't think I'd be as naive as Mrs. Suzman, Prime Minister. My politics is very much in tune with that of my father and my grandmother."
Which, of course, made her a Conservative. And now Forster's regard was sharp blue and attentive as he studied her.
"The world is changing, Prime Minister." Santan seized the moment. "One day there may even be a place in your cabinet for a woman, don't you think?"
Forster smiled and switched easily from English into Afrikaans.
"Even Dr. Courtney agrees that day is still very far ahead. However, I do concede that such a pretty face would do much to lighten the deliberations of us ugly old men."
The change of language was, of course, a test. Nobody in South Africa with political aspirations could survive without fluency in Afrikaans, the language of the politically dominant group. Isabella switched as easily as he had done. Her vocabulary was wide, her grammar perfect, and her accent rang sweetly even in the ear of a born Afrikaner. Forster smiled again, this time with pleasure, and continued the conversation for a few minutes, before glancing pointedly at his wristwatch and speaking to Santan.
I must go now. I have another function to attend. He turned back to Isabella. Tot ziens, Dr. Courtney, until we meet again. I will be watching your progress with interest.
Santan and Chaza walked with him from the marquee to where his official car and driver waited on the edge of the polo ground.
Tot ziens, Santan, Forster shook her hand. I congratulate you on the rearing of your granddaughter. I recognize many traits which she can only have inherited from you.
When Santan returned to the marquee, she looked around quickly. Isabella was already the center of a circle of eager males.
She has them panting like puppy dogs, Santan suppressed a smile and caught her granddaughter's eye. Isabella left her admirers and came to her immediately, and Santan took her arm in a comfortable, proprietorial gesture.
Well done, Missy. You behaved like a veteran. Uncle John likes you. I rather think that we are on our way.
That evening, only the family sat down to dinner at the long table in Filterfrieden's main dining room. However, Santan had ordered the antique Limoges dinner service and the best silver. The table was resplendent in candlelight and a mass display of yellow roses. As was usual on these family evenings, the women wore long dresses and the men were in black tie. Only Sean was missing. Sean had been invited, or rather Santan had summoned him, but he was hunting with one of his most valuable clients on the Rhodesian concession and had sent his humble apologies. Santan had accepted them reluctantly. She had wanted them all to celebrate her triumph with Dandy Lass, but she conceded that business came first. The German industrialist that Sean was guiding paid for 63 days of hunting each year at $500 a day. Of course, his vast business commitments in Germany would not allow him to spend that much time in the hunting field. He was lucky if he could fit in 2 weeks in any one year. However, he paid for the additional days to secure the right to hunt 3 elephant instead of 1. Sean had to be on call for him, even though he usually gave only a few days' notice of his intended arrival. Santan missed her eldest grandson. Sean was the handsomest and wildest of the three of them, but his presence was always stimulating. He seemed to charge the very air around him with the static electricity of danger and excitement. It had cost her and the family tens of thousands of dollars to bail him out of the various scrapes that his tempestuous nature led him into. Although she always expressed her outrage at these expenditures in the severest terms, secretly she did not grudge them. Her only fear was that one day Sean would go too far and get himself into real trouble, from which even Santan would be unable to extricate him. She dismissed that thought. Tonight was not the night for morbid fancies. The tall silver trophy glittered in the centre of the long table. It stood on a pyramid of yellow roses. It was strange what satisfaction that bauble gave her. It had cost her countless hours of hard work in the field, but the winning had made it all worthwhile. It had always been like that for her. The burning need to excel was in her blood. She had passed on that divine contagion to those she loved. At the far end of the table, Chaza tapped the crystal glass in front of him with a silver spoon, and in the ensuing silence rose to his feet. He was tall and elegant in his impeccable dinner jacket and black tie. He began one of those speeches for which he was renowned. Easy and flowing, the wit and sentiment so cleverly timed and blended that he could at one moment raise a storm of laughter and at the next moisten every eye with a skilfully turned phrase. Although he heaped her with praise and turned the attention of every person in the room full upon her, Santan found her own mind wandering to her other grandchildren. They were all hanging on their father's lips, so engrossed by his words that they were unaware of Santan's appraisal. Gary sat at her right hand, as befitted his importance in the family hierarchy. From the runt of the litter, myopic, weedy, and asthmatic, he had transformed himself, with little or no help from her or any of them, into this bull of power and confidence. Now he was the helmsman of the family fortune, chairman of Courtney Enterprises, his bulk threatening the fragile legs of the genuine Chippendale chair. His thumbs were hooked into the pockets of his discreetly brocaded waistcoat. His dress shirt was a snowy expanse over the great chest, and the starched wing collar too tight for a neck swollen not with fat, but with muscle and sinew. His dense black hair stood up in a coxcomb at the crown, and his thick horn-rimmed spectacles glittered in the candlelight. His laughter rocked the room, full and unrestrained. It greeted each of Shaz's sallies, and was so infectious that it transformed even his father's mildest remarks into wild hilarity. Santan switched her gaze to Gary's wife. Holly sat beside Shaza at the far end of the table. She was almost 10 years Gary's senior. Santan had opposed the union with all her power and cunning. Of course, she had not succeeded in preventing the marriage. She admitted to herself now that it had been a serious error of judgment to attempt to do so. She would now have had more control and influence over Holly had she not made the attempt. Instead, she had raised barricades of mistrust in Holly's mind that she might never be able to pull down. She had been wrong about Holly. She had proved the perfect wife for Gary. Holly had recognized those qualities in him that none of them, not even Santan, had fully perceived. She had brought them to full flower and carefully nurtured his self-confidence. In large measure, she was responsible for Gary's success. She had given him strength and unflagging support. She had given him love and happiness, and she had given him 3 sons and a daughter. Santan smiled as she thought of those little scamps asleep in the nursery wing upstairs, and then sighed and frowned. The reserve that Holly still felt towards her was a barrier between her and her great-grandchildren. Gary and Holly lived in Johannesburg, the nation's financial centre, 1,000 miles from Veldhoven. The head office of Courtney Enterprises was in Johannesburg, as was the stock exchange. Gary was one of the main players. He had to be at the centre of the arena. Thus there was every reason for him and Holly to have left Veldhoven. But Santan felt that Holly was keeping the children from her. Although it was only a 3-hour flight in the company jet, which Gary loved to pilot himself, yet these days Santan very seldom saw them at Veldhoven. She wanted desperately to have the children close to her, to guide and influence them, to protect and train them as she had their father. But Holly was the key. She would have to redouble her efforts to win her round. Now she deliberately caught her eye down the length of the long table, and smiled at her with all the warmth and affection she could convey. Holly smiled back, blonde and serene, her beauty given an extraordinary dimension by those party-coloured eyes, one blue, the other a startling violet. "I will make you like and trust me yet," Santan promised silently. "You will not be able to hold out forever, not against me. I'll have those children. This family is mine. Those children are mine. You'll not keep them from me much longer." Shaza had said something about her that she had missed in her preoccupation. Now every head at the table was turned towards Santan, and they were all applauding with enthusiasm. She smiled and nodded her acknowledgement of whatever compliment Shaza had paid her. And as the applause faded, Shaza continued. "You may have thought to yourselves, as you watched her handling Dandy Lass today, that it was a remarkable accomplishment. For any other woman it might have been so. But here we have the lady who faced down a man-eating lion with me as an infant strapped upon her back." Shaza was reciting once again all the old stories about her that were the weft and the warp of the family legend. In itself this recognition at every important occasion had become tradition, and though they had all heard them 100 times, their enjoyment was as fresh as ever. Only one person at the table looked faintly embarrassed by the extravagance of Shaza's eulogy. Santan felt a chill little breeze of annoyance ruffle the silken surface of her self-satisfaction. Of all her grandchildren, the one for whom she felt the least warmth and concern was Michael. He sat near the centre of the long table at the lowliest position, not simply because he was the youngest of her grandsons. Michael did not fit into Santan's scheme of things. There were secret depths and hidden places in his nature that she had not yet fathomed, and which therefore annoyed her. She had never been able to wean Michael away from his natural mother. Even the thought of Tara Courtney sent a scalding, acidic rush of hatred through Santan's bowels. Tara had outraged every principle and concept of decency and morality that Santan held sacrosanct. She was a Marxist and a misogynist, a traitor and a patricide. A portion of Santan's feelings towards Tara were passed on to this one of her sons.